so much for coming. Really appreciate it. I think this is going to be a really fun workshop. I'm actually delighted with the exact number of people. We were talking about this before, and we want to go deep. And this is going to be a good number to go deep. My name is Amanda Cassett. I was the Chief Marketing Officer at Consensus for the past 3.5 years. I have recently moved to focusing on blockchain consumer projects and dApps because I think the next wave of adoption is going to come from building products on the blockchain that people actually use to solve problems. So that's what I'm laser focused on right now. But this presentation will definitely draw on my experience, and the workshop hopefully will let us all kind of talk about how we tell our stories and optimize it and come together as a group to give each other feedback. But don't worry, they'll be made up stories unless you want them to be real stories. You won't have to share anything about your startup or yourself if you don't want to. Riley, do you want to introduce yourself?
I'm Riley Kim. I am the Asia Pacific PR for Consensus. I'm based out of Singapore, but I cover the Asia Pacific region. And this is a fantastic opportunity to plug into the Mandar with a global view, US-centric, Europe-centric, and then we get what it means for Asia moving ahead. And if you guys are interested in your stories for Asia, certain countries in Asia, what does that mean moving forward?
So we're
going to
kind of go through the history of the Ethereum narrative through the lens of the media, East and West. The present stories that are on people's minds and the opportunities to land certain kinds of narratives in the future. Then we're going to break into smaller groups and we're going to brainstorm pitches for the media. They don't have to be real pitches. They should be pitches for Ethereum startups or Ethereum projects. Then we're going to get back together as a group and we're going to pitch and we're going to workshop pitches. I think it'll be really valuable, and if you have a project or an idea that you are looking to sharpen your pitch for, this will be a great moment to do that. First, can we get a sense of where people are from? Who here is from North America? So a lot of people. Who here is from Asia? Well, it'll still be interesting to go over.
Europe or rest of the world?
Rest of the world? Where
Europe,
are you from?
Paris, France.
Oh, Paris. Okay. Who has work? Who has project or work in Asia, even if it may be Asia?
Yeah. Great. Well, it should be interesting for everyone. So when we talk about Ethereum, who is listening to us? The first thing when creating a narrative is thinking about your audience. Here are some facts about the audience for crypto and blockchain as it exists today. Americans have heard of crypto. It's pretty saturated. 81% of Americans have heard of at least one type of cryptocurrency, according to a YouGov poll. I believe that. But Ethereum name recognition is lagging far behind Bitcoin. 75% of adults in the US have heard of Bitcoin, 24% Bitcoin Cash, which I don't believe, by the way, because I think they just answered Bitcoin yes and didn't think about Bitcoin Cash. So have to think about all these big founders. And actually what we're doing in this workshop is thinking about how people think rather than thinking about facts. So this is a workshop about perception, not necessarily a workshop about facts, although sometimes you have to create facts for real in order to create narratives that will work, usually. So 24% Bitcoin Cash, which I think is actually more like 1%, and 17% have heard of Ethereum. So that's a big gap between 75% and 17%. You get a 75 on a test versus a 17 on a test. Those are two really different options for you. So then we tend to think about adoption, perception, narrative, so much in terms of the US market, but there are all these metrics by which Europe and Asia are outpacing the US, even if the US and the English-speaking market is the one driving the global news cycle, which it mostly is. So 41% of blockchain and crypto deals in Q2 2019 took place in Asia, 34% in Europe and 28% in the US.
What's the definition of the deal?
So I can send you the PwC report. So this is any kind of funding activity or an acquisition. So like a M&A or venture funding. So according to these metrics, the US amount of investment by several metrics is on the decline compared in comparison to Asia and Europe. And I don't know whether that's always going to be true or whether that's incredibly significant, but to think that everything is about the US market just because the English-speaking market is defining the news cycles just isn't true. So the audience is truly global. I think if you asked people where they thought the densest adoption of crypto was, maybe they'd say like South Korea, maybe they would say the US, but they wouldn't say Turkey, Brazil, and Colombia, but those are technically the densest per capita adoption of crypto today. So who is the audience? So in my role at Consensus and on the marketing team, we spend a lot of time identifying who the people are that are searching for Ethereum, that are interested in this space. And these aren't all of them, right? There are a lot of different people. This doesn't have humanitarian organizations and NGOs on here. It doesn't have really small groups of people on here. These are just kind of the macro. The biggest group is crypto buyers or potential buyers, and they're looking for market signals. They're looking at the price. They're trying to figure out what to do with their holdings. You have tech enthusiasts, so they're staying up to date on new trends in the industry. Maybe they're also researching machine learning, robotics, space travel. Maybe they follow Elon Musk and TechCrunch. Government officials are looking to form opinions on emerging technologies. Is this risky? How should my agency act regarding a new technology? Tech professionals, what kind of ways should I upskill myself? Do I have a potential new job in a different kind of industry that I could get? Business decision makers. So that's at all different levels of an enterprise or of a startup. Is this a new way to make money? Could I make new kinds of partnerships? Could I integrate a new kind of technology that would make my business more efficient or that would allow me to sell something new? Entrepreneurs, what kind of company should I start? What kind of company should I join? Startup investors, whether they're ready to enter the market or not, they're thinking about investment targets. And then news consumers end up hearing about Ethereum, blockchain, Bitcoin, if they just read top global news stories, but they only hear about it very rarely. So they just get these couple of little touch points. So this is a reality check. This little presentation is full of sort of real life stuff. And I know at DEF CON, we tend to be very idealistic and optimistic. And I am incredibly optimistic about Ethereum and about this space and about this community. But I think it's important to recognize most people searching for Ethereum care about price. Period. Full stop. And that's just true. It might not always be true, but it is true right now. And if you look at the numbers, they'll make you cry every time. And if you didn't believe me, this Google search volume for Ethereum chart maps onto a certain set of activities in 2017, a certain set of facts, and you can see that more people are looking for Ethereum during the moments when the price was in the news for being the highest. There were other news stories about Ethereum during that time, but those were often connected to the fact that the price was increasing, which was driving other news coverage. There's a flywheel. And so I guess the point I'm trying to make with this is that the news coverage about the price increases genuinely brings more searchers into the space, even if you end up capturing those searchers and funneling them toward doing something else. So just because people come in for the price, it doesn't mean they'll stay for the price. You know, they might come in for something, and you can convince them to be interested in something else. Maybe. We haven't yet. And then just to put this in perspective, so I think having perspective on all of this is really important. So this is Ethereum versus Bitcoin search volume. Remember that 75%, 17%, 75 on a test is a C, 17% on a test is get out of town. Yeah, that's where we are. So what have people heard about Ethereum so far? Well, mostly nothing, but that's an opportunity. There's that story in marketing about the marketer who goes to represent the shoe company and is sent to a village where they're thinking of opening a shoe factory, and the marketer reports back to his boss, they don't wear shoes here, so we can't open a shoe factory. But the other one says, they don't wear shoes here, let's start a shoe factory. So the fact that people haven't heard about Ethereum yet, or only 17% of Americans, is an incredible opportunity and a clean slate to educate people about Ethereum, which is amazing because sometimes we think of Ethereum or crypto in general as having a negative perception from all the different market cycles or from the ICO boom, but most people just have no perception at all. So it could be a good thing. And this is a quote from Matt Leising at Bloomberg. We interviewed a bunch of journalists creating this presentation, so we sort of reverse interviewed them to be able to present to you straight from the source what journalists are saying and what they want. So Matt Leising has been covering the space for years, since 2016, the same year I joined the space, at Bloomberg. And he wrote, I'm not sure the public knows about Ethereum at all. When I explain the book I'm writing, I always have to start with Bitcoin. And most people say, sure, I've heard of that. Ethereum is the next level beyond what Bitcoin can do. So there's no narrative now for the vast majority of people. There's this enormous opportunity. So here are the journalists that I interviewed, and then we'll go through the ones from East, which Riley interviewed, the East of our world. So Matt Leising from Bloomberg, Laura Shin from Unchained, who used to work at Forbes, Bob Hackett from Fortune and Fortune's spin-off, that's an internal publication that specifically covers crypto blockchain called The Ledger, and that's Bob Hackett, Josh Quitner, who started Decrypt, and Lee Kuen from CoinDesk. And these are really different publications. And we're gonna talk about that a little bit. So Bloomberg is a business publication. So if you send Matt Leising a pitch about a startup that's doing its first product launch, that's not the right thing. But if you pitch Matt Leising about Microsoft incorporating the Ethereum blockchain into 100% of its tooling, that's a Matt Leising story. Laura Shin, she has a podcast, so she's not going to cover like a single kind of daily news item scoop on a podcast. She's going to bring someone on to have a thoughtful conversation that takes a long time about an issue that's in the news these days. So it's going to be someone. So she'd have someone on speaking about DeFi as a concept, or speaking about Ethereum 2.0. But she probably wouldn't have she wouldn't cover the latest release of your DApp, even if it has a ton of users. Bob Hackett would. He would love to cover a story about usage. And same with Josh Quitner from Decrypt. They both would cover, and so would Lee. All three of those would cover more of like a daily breaking news kind of story. Decrypt also does deep dives. And actually, all three of those sort of do deep dives. I would say that CoinDesk can be very critical. It's also one of the best known industry publications about blockchain and crypto. Decrypt tends to be more positive about blockchain and crypto startups, but it has a pretty high barrier to entry to get coverage there. And then The Ledger, same thing, because they're part of Fortune, they're a little bit more interested in the business side as opposed to like the culture and the community. They probably wouldn't cover like that Vitalik wore a cat t-shirt. They wouldn't cover gossip from the community. They'd cover more like business news. Whereas CoinDesk sometimes really covered gossip, which is interesting because these are all really different publications. And when you're thinking about telling your story to a publication, it's not like you have a fixed story and you just blast that out to everybody. You think about what they do and what they want, and you tailor how you communicate with them and how you tell your story to them based on what's actually up with them. Do you want to talk about the...
Yes, thank you. So for Asia, Asia is quite different. The media landscape is almost by definition in a different stage of maturity compared to the West, and by West is largely US and perhaps Eurocentric, so especially London, which is English, which comes to the point of language. One main thing that we really notice when reaching out to all of us here in the region is it's quite fragmented, and part of it is because of language, and language is national. So if you look at someone from Korea Times, basically they'll be interested in anyone, any stories that has national alignment or national interest. For instance, if Samsung was going to do something, I wouldn't pitch that to Block Temple in Taipei. It has to land with the country. So their interest, as opposed to what Amanda mentioned, there are different layers when you look at media in the West or international media, Bloomberg versus Decrypt versus CoinDesk. In Asia, it's largely still national. So if there are stories which are transnational, then perhaps you could go with someone like a Bloomberg, which tends to have a regional view of how the Asia trends are. With these guys, however, with the crypto media, however, it has to land in their own backyard. So that is something you will come to, because this ties back to language, and I'll link back to that as well.
So, gonna go through the widely known Ethereum story so far, and this is coming from the English-speaking market, but it's global, because a lot of what people read in, say, Japan is going to be from, let's say, CoinDesk or Bloomberg, and it's going to be translated over, but and then after that, we're going to go into how they specifically that the media coverage is different by region. So this is not the story of the most important things about Ethereum according to this community. These are the things that passed some kind of activation threshold where a lot of people ended up knowing about them. And let's keep a lot of people in perspective because that's within the 17%. So these are the things that registered in the global consciousness among that 17%, which is probably lower globally, that's just for America. And this is according to the journalists we spoke to. These were the ones that they all mentioned as kind of tentpole moments. So Bitcoin is emerging in 2009 as a niche. Really good coverage as the price hits, as the price goes over $1,000. Then was Silicon Valley funding wallets and exchanges for Bitcoin. Then the Silk Road scandal in 2011. And the Silk Road scandal and Bitcoin hitting over $1,000 blew open the Bitcoin space, but not even that blown open. Let's keep the 75% in perspective too. So the early days of Ethereum, the things that all of the journalists we talked to agreed registered was Vitalik's identity. So the fact that he was 19 years old really registered with people, his persona, his story. So you'll see in a lot of the initial coverage, this sort of whiz kid narrative. And journalists are trying to tell stories about people. People tend to be interested in people, and stories about people tend to spread memetically a little bit more easily than stories about ideas. As a Bitcoin alternative, social good potential was covered a lot, and that's something that the kind of PR and marketing of the industry was successful at early on, telling a story that was going to help people. And we can talk about how that maybe was a problem in a way in the end. But talking about the social good potential, then the DAO hack. Right, so that was, I remember I was at a barbecue and I was with this guy and he got a text from his mother saying, is this the thing you work on? Or was it grandmother?
Grandmother
well, saying, is this, because it was on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. So, you know, this Ethereum thing got hacked. We're talking about perception, right? So we're only talking about perception. This is so frustrating for people that are deep in the community, this gap, but this is what registered. So then this rapid growth moment. In February of 2017, the Enterprise Ethereum Alliance launches. Super significant because now you have these big corporates that are co-signing Ethereum in a way, saying this is something worthy of exploration, giving it some more legitimacy. Because even though we have this young genius Vitalik story, it lacks that kind of gravitas cosign of some of these big names. Then we have the ICO boom, we're hearing about token fever, we have CryptoKitties jamming up the Ethereum blockchain with overuse, which highlights the need for scaling. And then we start having competition for L1. So you get a certain billboard in Times Square, you get a lot of projects positioning themselves as Ethereum killers, which is actually just great for Ethereum on SEO, So you start having that kind of narrative. In 2018, 2019, in a period that I'm generously terming recalibration, regulatory activity is getting started. So you hear about SEC enforcement, you hear about CFTC, you get a market contraction. You get the rise of something called DeFi lately, and you get some really interesting enterprise activity. You get Facebook, Libra, Calibra, you get JP Morgan Coin, you get Ernst & Young, which registered for adopting public blockchain. So those are some examples of stories that registered. I think those are really the only stories that registered for most people that were within the 17%. Within the community, we know so much more than this, but these are what everybody that we talked to among the journalists agreed on, really kind of broke through. And this is just a reminder that sometimes stories don't do what you think they do. So this is from Bob Hackett at Fortune. The DAO hack gave Ethereum name recognition, kind of like any press is good press. It was an early test of Ethereum's resilience. And let me explain that a little bit. So you have Ethereum DAO hacked on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, and you think, that is a bad negative word, so that's bad for Ethereum, right? Not necessarily, because the fact that someone hacked something means that there was something valuable there. So it seems like someone was trying to get something. The amount of money is a high amount of money, so it makes you pay attention. And there's this word Ethereum that's picking up SEO juice because it got that big front page story, which means something else that Ethereum does is more likely to get covered, because the journalists who are incentivized by trying to get traffic to their content are going to want to put Ethereum in a headline more than they did before. Not that much, right, 17%, but more than they did before. So if you want to tell a positive story about Ethereum, you're going to have a higher chance of being able to tell a positive story about Ethereum after Ethereum DAO hacked. See, does everybody get that? But it's in the moment, especially if it's your project, you're like, oh my God, this is bad. And sometimes it is bad. Sometimes bad press is really bad press. But there are just all these nuances to it that are really important to think about too. So you'll notice that right now there are certain kinds of stories that are told a lot about blockchain and crypto and Ethereum, and certain ones that we talk about in the community all the time that aren't. Why are some stories told and some stories not told? Told stories, funding, sales, acquisitions, token prices, regulatory actions, prominent individuals, prominent companies, user numbers. Untold stories, the fact that we've been building this whole time with so much enthusiasm, despite the market contractions, that's not a very widely known story. That, you know, at least in my opinion, US regulators have taken a really thoughtful and nuanced position on Ethereum and Bitcoin. It's not like there's some big smackdown. It's actually been a really thoughtful conversation. And then people associate all crypto with crime still because of Silk Road. And the best way to fund crime is still cash, because it's truly an anonymous currency. So the association of crime with all cryptos doesn't always make sense, and comes from, you know, just the types of media narratives that have broken through and formed kind of false associations. So what do these told stories have in common, and what do these untold stories have in common? So these told stories have properties that make for a headline that's going to get clicked on a lot, and that's going to get shared a lot. So the names of prominent individuals and prominent companies can be put in a headline that's going to get the headline SEO juice, or it's going to be clicked on more. Regulatory actions, you know, someone cracking down, the SEC has a big SEO name, people always want to hear kind of the juicy gossip, or, you know, what went wrong. User numbers, that can be a really big positive. People want numbers. Journalists love putting numbers in headlines. Like, numbers is such a consistent thing, because they want to. Journalists care about conveying the fact that they're really bringing you value and delivering information. And the fact that they can take a number and tell it to you is a way for them to be delivering value, and those stories tend to share more. Funding, sales, acquisitions, those are really concrete facts. And I think right now, journalists in the space are scared to talk about anything that's not super concrete, because there was so much stuff that wasn't true that they got sold on a couple years ago. So what stories will we tell about Ethereum in the future? And this is just the global perspective. This is what our journalists say that they're looking for, that we spoke to. So one theme that came up was the growth of DeFi, decentralized finance. So Lee Kuan said, since the ICO boom, this concept of decentralized finance has really taken off. But Matt Leasing was skeptical. I don't even know what DeFi means. It feels very buzzwordy to me. I think it's just a paradigm that people are creating to escape from Bank of America. So then prices and numbers matter. So Josh Kuttner is saying, we know our readers really care about the price, making Ethereum better, bigger, and more popular. And so real users, real problem solving, which gets back to the theme of numbers. Numbers or evidence of some sort is important. You need to explain the facts and statistics why. The other thing that helps the journalists understand is make sure they understand the problem and how the thing is going to solve the problem. A lot of times, she was saying, blockchain projects seem like they're solutions in search of problems. And then people want to cover Ethereum 2.0 and the roadmap. The scaling of the technology and getting it to work well will define whether or not we end up needing to talk about Ethereum L1 competitors. So unless this scaling and 2.0 jam works out, from the lens of media and perception, that's going to define whether or not a bunch of other L1s become major topics of conversation. This is stuff that journalists say they probably won't cover right now. So ideas or future plans without some kind of factual, grounded, or numerical hook. So this is something I've overheard at Ethereal Tel Aviv, which just made me laugh. I've learned covering this industry since 2017 to ignore the ideas and just focus on the money. So another one was, I love Josh Quicker. Everyone is hungry for bacon, not sizzle. People don't want to cover another blockchain startup unless it's weird or different. People don't want to cover yet another enterprise press release. Bob used to cover every press release he got of transitioning a back-end process to a blockchain. Now it's so many releases that it's boring, so we won't do it. And then, like we said before, people don't want to be pitched the wrong story for their outlet. And if you spam journalists with pitches that aren't right for them, they'll remember that forever and not cover you. Because they just don't like being bothered with bad stuff. You know, they get damaged. Let's move east.
So I think just to kick things off, there's always this issue of Asia. But the problem is how you define Asia itself. Right now we are in Asia, but if your first visit was in Japan, it's going to be very different if your first visit was, let's say, Singapore or Malaysia or Thailand or China or even parts of China. And that's the sort of situation. It's a reality that we deal with, but you have to dissect it somehow. So if you look at the definition of, you often hear this tossed around a lot, Asia Pacific, which has conventionally covered Australia, which sort of covers the Pacific Ocean. The term itself, Pacific, comes from the Pacific Ocean. And I got this little chart. So the one in the background is actually how the CIA World Factbook looks at Asia, which sort of touch on Russia via North Pacific. Now, in the past 7-8 years, we start to see the term Indo-Pacific comes up via the Indian Ocean. That has sort of a geopolitical hint to it because of how India is coming up. Sorry, that's where the word Indo-Pacific, we may see more of it, but it really depends on how the geopolitical stage plays out. We probably see the word East Asia quite frequently, and that translates to, generally speaking, Japan, Korea, China somehow, and then Taiwan as well. And then there's the North and South Asia divide. North Asia generally, you know, China definitely in it. South Asia generally, India, Pakistan, that sort of space. And then Southeast Asia is tossed around a lot as well. These are some of the most dense, most culturally diverse. It is, I think, bilingually the most culturally diverse place on Earth, Southeast Asia itself. And we have the ASEAN, the 10-nation bloc. I didn't even touch on West Asia, because that's really not in the imagination, generally speaking. West Asia sort of touched on I would say, East Europe, but that space is kind of forgotten. Maybe that's an opportunity. We don't know, but we have to start from, you know, some kind of departure. But the best way to approach, I feel, would be looking at the region as a whole, via two tracks, via the economy, the state of their economy, the state of how their market is. Generally, we look at it via advanced or developed nations and the ones that are still developing, and what does this mean for your story. Now, advanced economies tend to be the ones like this year. Japan, Korea, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore, China, it's, I put an asterisk there because there are a lot of qualification. It is largely still developing, but definitely, as we all know right now, a huge growing middle class. The common things with this nation is they're very familiar with financial instruments. They already have records of savings, they know about trade, they know about debt, they know about credit cards. The question becomes, from an Ethereum, from a blockchain point of view, what's the catalyst for them? If they are in it for the trade, what's in it for them from a story point of view after just trading? If all they know is, you know, when you talk about Ethereum, when you talk about blockchain to them, if all they know is prices like what Amanda pointed out, what's in it for them after this? One thing we realize for these developed nations, when I speak with a lot of them, it's all about compatibility. Because these are mature nations, by default, their infrastructure is really quite mature. If that is the case, where does your story come in? Where does your product come in? How do you come in? What sort of solutions are you bringing in? Are you being disruptive in a good way? Are you seen as disruptive in a bad way? This is inherent. We are in Japan right now, and I think this is something you guys might have experienced. Japan is a very interesting case across Asia because they are extremely, I would say, still culturally loyal to cash. Amazing convenience machine all over the country that you can use your coins, which I'm sure you have a lot by now. It's really good. I really love their convenience machine. One thing I ask, why is there a stickiness with cash? And I didn't think about it, but Japan is one of the safest places on the planet. You literally could lose your wallet with, I don't know, thousands of dollars, and then it will be returned to you, provided you have your ID card. That probably won't happen in a lot of other places. There is this trust element that is very inherent here, and it's something to think about when you think about the concept of trust, because that's inherent in blockchain and Ethereum as well. With South Korea, neighbors to Japan, a bit of tension going right now, but they focus much more on the ease of use. So again, when you think about the infrastructure they have, how are you going to be compatible with that? Singapore, where I'm from, so post-war rapid growth, we are seeing a bit of a generation gap because the nation has really grown in like, 3 decades to become first world. There is a gap between what we call the elder generation who are not that familiar with the internet. How do we get them on board? If your product is going to really serve the masses, as some products claim to be, how do you reach them? We have to talk about that. China is the one I put an asterisk. You must have heard of WeChat by now, TikTok. These are China products, Chinese products, and they're miles ahead from that point of view due to near universal adoption. Just as a fun fact, the government of Singapore is actually very impressed by how China has gotten pretty much cashless. It's something that the Singapore government is trying to catch up without leaving people behind. Onto the developing nations, these are the ones that we kind of more or less define them as. Most of them are in the Southeast Asia region, Indonesia, Philippines, still the largest market. Vietnam has somewhat become the new China because of it's becoming the place to go for manufacturing. As labor cost rises in China, production is moved to Vietnam. Thailand is becoming more interesting for blockchain. I'll touch on that briefly. Malaysia, Myanmar, and then for them, as opposed to the previous slide where we talk about competitiveness, when we talk about this developing markets, for blockchain, we often talk about the word financial inclusion. You have to remember for this market, financial inclusion really matters because a large portion of the guys who are unbanked, what we often say, underserved, they don't have ID, they don't have a bank account. This is what really matters to them. You know, in some case, I won't say it's life and death, but it makes a huge impact on their communities. And from that, you can tally on to what the government think of in terms of why do we want blockchain in our backyard? Because it helps with education, it helps with upskilling them, and it brings them up to speed with the rest of the developed nation. So this is the sort of point that is really important here. I will harp on this a little bit more because when we talk about financial inclusion, does it matter to me if I'm a Japanese citizen with already 5 credit cards? I don't really need financial inclusion. But if I'm in the Philippines, I'm in a rural island, I work with a community bank that isn't plugged into the system. I need that.
Do you have, in the developing markets, somewhat American naive question, but do you have like cell phone model and coverage?
Yes. So broadly speaking, I would say it depends though. We will still, again, it's so diverse, it depends on where you are, but as a broad stroke, most of the developing markets, they will have more cell phones than bank and IDs. So that's the opportunity to come in from, you know, internet connectivity.
And there's a certain level of smartphone that's the dominant?
Android, cheaper.
Right, but like at what level?
At what, a penetration level. I have to get the stats for you, but I would believe, okay, it differs by country, but just offhand, it would probably be 70 to 80% versus the actual number of users who don't have a banking account. That disparate figures. I can get it for you then, definitely, but it's very, very clear. So again, we come back to infrastructure. So for this country itself, it's all about the opportunities to plug the gaps in their largest. Just some general statistics. Indonesia is an interesting one. They have sort of always been, Indonesia and Philippines, that's always been the go-to market to test for countries that are starting up shop in Southeast Asia when they want to draw out startups. So for instance, partly is because there is so much gaps in the infrastructure. So if your product can be compatible, can provide a good service, the adoption is actually very swift. Grab itself effectively displaced Uber out of the space. So that's how fast the adoption can be. Philippines is something, I can talk a little bit more, but maybe not right now. Project I2I is something that Consensus work on with the Union Bank of Philippines. I would say the thesis behind it is financial inclusion. Philippines is one of the nations that has about 10% of the GDP come from remittance. And if they rely on the existing service of paying up to 7 to 10% of remittance, fee on remittance, that's really not something that's helpful for them. If we are able to bring it down to 5% or even lower than that, that's the impact we're trying to create. So if you Google Union Bank I2I, you actually see a lot of hits, and we're very happy about that. Thailand, so this is the one that's sort of interesting. We haven't really had a lot of taps on that, but you would, again, if you Google it, you see a lot of new legislation coming up just this month itself. So I would sort of look at it from this dual track. To tackle Asia itself. Where are you and what's the problem you're trying to solve and what are the roadblocks that you come across? Now, I can't cover the whole of Asia. That's impossible. It's about 4.6 billion. But we're going to just focus a bit more on East Asia by definition that we are here in Japan. I'm going to touch on Japan really quickly. So right now it's an exciting place to be. So next year, obviously, Summer Olympics is here. Earlier this year, the G20 summit was held in Osaka as well. They talk about the Japan Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. He talked about digital trust, the digital trust economy. They expect really a lot of things to come up from the digital economy. As a country itself, Japan has somewhat been interesting because post-war is really successful. Household names, Sony to Panasonic. They have sort of fallen behind a little bit, including culturally, where K-pop has really taken over the stage. So they are aware of this. The banking system in Japan has very aggressively looking at exporting, partly because the demographics in Japan, like most other developed nations, it's aging. They need to look globally. So you have to think of that when you are thinking of if your product is something that does with financial services in Japan, how does that come into play? Sorry, you have tickets to two of the matches that are cancelled tomorrow, by the way. On to South Korea. Just as a fun fact for when things are, if you are familiar with the boy band BTS, I'm not, but apparently they account for 4.65 billion of the country's GDP. Just so you know how impactful South Korea is.
So if your startup is a boy band, this might be really great.
Boy band or interior. Just to give you a bit of context, that puts them in the space of Samsung and Hyundai. That's a sort of a place where Korea is right now. So when I look at some of the statistics when we work from Consensus of us, we get a lot of hits from Korea. We get a lot of news. Every other week, every other day, we see something coming out of South Korea, a new development, sort of a new startup, and it's an exciting place to be honest. Now onto China, which as a region is a bit trickier. I label it by language instead, Greater China, the Mandarin speaking region. Obviously that's mainland China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, to some degree Singapore by linguistic heritage. So this space itself is a bit different. Let's start with mainland China itself. I mentioned earlier with WeChat. With China, I think, actually I think I have a slide here, sorry. I'll do this in three. So for this was actually a photo I took when I just came in from Seoul, Tokyo, at a shop I wanted to have udon. They didn't take my credit card. It was a good thing I have cash though. It wasn't very expensive, but that's when I started asking around, and I found out that it's just a cultural thing because it's such a safe nation. If you lose your wallet, you will get it. Earlier on, Amanda showed a good, very good slide about the DAO hack. I asked around about the DAO and the Mount Box. Apparently, it wasn't really a thing. It's back in the news again just by location, but it's actually not in the public imagination, I would say. The other interesting thing that we mentioned, that I mentioned about Tokyo 2020, let me see if there's anything else on the cover. Rakuten Wallet line. Okay, I think I'm good here. For Korea, yeah. What I mentioned, less sticky with cash. As opposed to Japan, which emphasizes quality of service, Japan is very, I would say, culturally, perfection is important to them. So I think from a blockchain point of view, blockchain has to be, smart contract audits. So in Japan, the tolerance level for errors is very low, so you have to think about that. In Korea, it's a bit different. They are much more concerned with efficiency, less sticky with cash. This code itself, why do I have to unlock an app key, my PIN versus just swapping my card, came from a journalist at Korea Times when we were talking about it. And it kind of makes sense if you think about it. Again, if I'm already in the developer nation, I have a number of credit cards, I have, if I use an iPhone, I have digital credit cards itself. What makes it compelling for me to not use that and use some sort of blockchain-enabled payment system if I have to unlock it, key in my PIN? We all talk about the inability to remember your child faces. So this is something to think about, again, if you're looking at something from a consumer point of view. I'm not sure whether you're familiar with Chaibos. That's the traditionally family-run conglomerate. So I would say the economy is largely driven by this culture of conglomerates, the Samsung, the LG, the Hyundai's. For them, these are largely conservative, traditional, family-owned businesses. They wouldn't be as risky as a lot of other countries, a lot of other companies in other countries. So that's where we start to see a culture of them promoting and partnering startups. What this means is they may not want to actually do it themselves. They are happy to fund or find partners to fund, and it's something that they can partner with. Clayton, I think I pronounced it correctly. Clayton is something that came out of Kakao. Kakao is basically the platform, the way that China has WeChat. Kakao Talk is the platform for South Korea. Obviously, you have Line, you have Telegram, but Kakao is basically it. So this is one way that a big company like Kakao comes on board, not directly in their department. Perhaps it's a brand and risk management profile, but it's just something to think about if you are going to work with these companies. And to some extent, if you can partner one, it probably gives you a lot of knowledge because they will have mass capacity. Again, a lot of news around the existing financial system. We've seen a lot of news from Samsung, Hana Bank, LG itself. And again, onto the Chinese-speaking geographies. I want to go there by a specific region. For China, let's do that first. China in itself is, I don't know where to begin. That's why I spoke to a few journalists, and we can look at it by tiering. The first tier cities, Beijing, Shanghai, Hangzhou, Shenzhen, and then the second one with Nanjing, Xiamen. Chengdu is the one that has a lot of mining because of geothermal energy. But I would say with China, it's a tricky one for interior. Partly because I'm sure you guys would have heard the 2017 ICO ban, and when the Chinese government does something, the Chinese government does something. And effectively, what happened previously, Ethereum was pretty much known as a good education platform. So universities, government was exploring it. But when the ban happened, they sort of played conservative. They didn't want to talk about Ethereum. It became an opportunity for Hyperledger Fabric. So universities, governments are actually more experimenting on it. Just as a fun fact, we did a hackathon in the country, representing another country. I probably wouldn't go to the media. They were surprised to see the number of people using Ethereum. What I meant was the developers in China at a hackathon, they was about 90%, I believe, did it on Ethereum, and the local representative was a bit surprised because of how pervasive the conversation around Fabric is for the business side of things. So I think this is something we want to be aware of representing the Ethereum community. I asked about what's for them moving ahead. the conversation that Amanda mentioned, DeFi, from the developer's point of view, yes, they see the wider financial world itself. The media, however, they are sticky about price itself. Again, so this is something you have to deal with this. We have to look at it from that as well as where we are. If the ICO bag doesn't move and the conversation is still around Hyperledger Fabric for enterprise, where do you come in when you represent Ethereum? With Taiwan, however, it's a bit different. Although linguistically, obviously there's a lot of exchange, the Ethereum scene is actually very lively. And I understand part of it is the job. Kudos to the foundation. Vitalik has been very active there. What Amanda mentioned earlier, in this, I would say about 2015, 2016, Vitalik probably is still seen as a prodigy there. Everywhere, yes, in Singapore as well, yeah. So when we talk about blockchain, they tend to equate it with Ethereum. That's good. It's actually over Bitcoin. So when you talk to the developers, they equate it quite strongly with Ethereum. Most of the developers, they're pretty familiar with the programming, the smart contract. When I ask a little bit more, I get a sense that everyone knows it, but no one knows the depth of it. They know it at the superficial level. Smart contract, everyone can say that. What's beyond that? Sharding, sidechain, that's something that's a gap itself. We see that's a gap. Something that you guys should know as well. So when I look at it, when I ask the question, what about moving ahead? What are the stories you see? They are starting to say there is a sense of, I guess, to put it frankly, impatient. They're waiting for 2.0, and they want to see what's going to happen. When EOS went live, they obviously will be curious to experiment. They are all basically asking, we are already familiar with a smart contract, what is next? They are waiting for 2.0 is what I'm saying. For Hong Kong and Singapore, financial trading hub, for them, the main thing I would say is largely similar to Japan and Korea, already very developed, credit cards abound, people are familiar with trading. Digital banking is something that's fairly new in these two markets. So earlier this year in Hong Kong and in Singapore, the central bank announced that they'll be issuing what we call internet or digital-only banks. In some region, we call them neobanks. It's something that I believe is very new in these two markets. The idea is that this would digital banks will be able to challenge traditional financial banking. So the interesting thing for them is you don't have to come from, your genesis doesn't have to be a bank to apply for this license. You could be Uber, for instance. You could be a telco. And it's interesting because Uber telcos, by default, they already have a large following. And they're forcing the traditional banks to basically make changes. This leads to the question, where will Ethereum be when we talk about the future of money for financial trading hubs? We already have TransferWise, Revolut, PayNow, PayLine, something that's big in Singapore and across the Southeast Asian market as well. So these are certain pillars you should think about if you're tackling this market. This is something I wouldn't really call a country, but really by the fact that they share a common language, largely. I sort of covered the three main regions I want to cover for East Asia, and I also want to sort of, I guess, to bring it back to where Amanda started. Now, when we talk about Asia, when we talk about stories itself, it's very linguistic focused, it's very national focused, and the reason I'm brought on by Amanda, and thank you so much, was when we're thinking about this topic itself, when we look at it, we all speak English, but what about readers who are based in Japan or Korea, and they could only, let's say, contend with their own language? What would they be reading? Obviously, content from CoinDesk, which I believe June is here, on CoinDesk will be translated and it gets picked up. But what happens to content that's truly local? If I want to represent the Korean market, if I'm a journalist, I'm hungry for Korean-only stories, where do I begin? And where are your opportunities? Early on, Amanda had a good slide that talked about the tempo moments. Again, when I asked about it, Mt. Gox DAO really wasn't in the public memory. Even now, when I asked the editor at D Street, they are a crypto media in Korea, he was showing me how things rank. It's basically all Ethereum 2.0, Vitalik. DAO isn't even up in the top 5. This is what he told me. I can't be sure, I don't speak Korean. However, I would still say the influence of where news come from, in the US is still interesting, because when I think about what happened in Asia, when the Ethereum popped into our public imagination, these 3 years, 2016, 2017, 2018, we all know what about 2017 and 2018. So 2016, two things happened on the global stage that affected how Ethereum was covered and how blockchain was covered in parts of Asia. These two things happened. Do you want to make a guess what these two things? things are in 2016. Anyone?
ICOs?
Not quite. That's more 2017. So 2016, two things that happened wasn't really Asia itself. It was the Brexit vote, and it was the presidential election that got struck. So what happened was when these two things happened, immediately the prices of cryptocurrency spiked a little bit. And then from there, you have the conversation about it became a crypto assets basically a safe harbor and an alternative. That is the moment when Asia started to look at prices itself, and when that's the moment when people started to look at Ethereum, blockchain, Bitcoin. So that happened in 2016. So it's good to know that we want local stories in Asia, but it's also good to know that there is still some form of entanglement with the global stage. And that's something that is, yeah.
And that story didn't really register in the English-speaking market. Nobody was thinking, very few people were thinking that. There might have been one or two stories about it, but that's not what was capturing attention. So that's
It was an interesting disconnect that we found really interesting. Like, Amanda was telling me again, Malgox DAO, that totally didn't land well. But instead, it was Brexit, it was Trump, and then they started to associate the prices. And then for 2017, ICO. 2018, again, the price discussion. But now in 2019, I think what Amanda mentioned about recalibration has a lot of... it's pretty legit. The conversation in Asia is now pretty much into the enterprise side of things. I think moving ahead, we ask the question, you know, what's the next narrative for Ethereum? For Asia, what's the next narrative? I've explained how the regional blocks work, the dual economies, and the question that we pose back to you, is there a narrative for Asia? Is there a single narrative for Asia? Is there a single narrative for Korea, Japan, or Southeast Asia, if that's a space you want to go after? What do the youth, what do the media need? What kind of stories are you putting out? That wonderful quote, Bacon and Caesar. So I think these are the kind of a conversation we want to kickstart in this workshop. What are we innovating and who are you impacting? I think that's it from my end.
Great. So now it's time for us to practice making some sizzle. And it should be the kind of sizzle that makes it really seem like there's bacon. Does that land with everyone? Okay, good. Laugh if that landed with you. Okay, great. Well, we're gonna split into groups, and we have some real journalists here, which is great, and some people that are very practiced at speaking to press and representing different projects. You guys are scared of breaking into little groups.
It's a workshop. It's a
workshop.
It's a workshop, man.
All right. Well,
we're going to have one big group.
So I was thinking, maybe if we... That seems like a reaction. That seems like a market reaction that people don't want to bring into small groups and do this exercise. Is that true?
No. Yeah, probably.
I think it is.
Who wants to break into groups and do this exercise? You want to break into groups and do this. Who does not want to do that?
Who has questions as well? Yeah.
Oh, maybe we should do questions first. You want to do questions first? Great, let's do questions first.
I had a question back to I'm sorry, did you? Oh, slide one. You don't have to go back to it. I think you said that, now I forgot my question. there's more growth outside of the U.S. Do you feel that's attributed to regulatory culture in the U.S.? Or
that was a stat from a PwC report from one quarter, and the point of my including it was that even though so much of the global narrative around crypto and blockchain is shaped by the English-speaking market, not all, but some. That isn't actually dominant in terms of where all of the activity is happening, and there's so much activity in Asia and Europe, even though they're not the ones setting the story, oftentimes. So that was kind of the point of my including that, not so much to say that the U.S. is not interested. It's almost to say these other areas are increasingly interested. Yes.
Hi. Great talk. I've lived throughout Southeast Asia and China and Africa. The U.S. is only maybe a quarter of the market of what's happening. And I think it's because the population of the United States is 350 million as opposed to the rest of the population around the world. So that's probably why there's a lot more interest and activity outside the United States. But a lot of what we're seeing is, what I'm seeing outside the United States is a lot of the thought process is being driven by the United States, even though it doesn't even make up a quarter of what is happening in the rest of the world. So how do you include and how do you, from a, because both of you are from two different continents and two different sides of the planet, how do you guys collaborate and how do you include and how do you get that message out as a singular message to the rest of the economies and the rest of the activity, and how do you make sure that when you do report on a subject matter that you're taking in the perspective of many different economies and many different perspectives and many different countries and report as a one unit of information that everybody can understand and apply in their ecosystem?
I'm going to tell you two mini stories that point to the necessity of localizing messages. And the first is that if you translate the word decentralized literally into Japanese, it means soulless.
Yeah.
And if you
think about that,
that makes sense, you know? It's like, in a metaphorical way, it's like your like soul thing is all over the place, and it seems like maybe it's split apart into little shards. And, you know, that also makes sense. And the word, I think, I don't know if it's blockchain theory or decentralization, but it was one of our core key terms, is very close in Mandarin to the word revenge. And actually, we were working on, it was in Korean. We were localized, I was working with the EF, helping to localize the Ethereum.org website, and we did like an algorithmic sweep and then we had a human sweep. And the human sweep was like, oh my goodness, every time this thing says blockchain, it said it means revenge. It was wild. It was really interesting.
After living in China and learning how Starbucks moved into China, Xingbake, they had to think of each of the characters, or Kentucky Fried Chicken, Kentucky, or McDonald's, McDonald's. You know, they had to have a common thread to the name to advertise who they are, but they had to have it communicated inside that community and that ecosystem and that country in that language from that perspective.
What's
so everybody kind of got it. So how do you, and that's exactly the soulless point is what I'm thinking about and the different languages being applied to the messages.
Well, it's not even about just the words in different languages. The words and languages, if you kind of believe the Saber-Whorf hypothesis, emerge from like a system of thinking that's embodied by a language. And so it's not just about realizing that the thing you auto-translated something into Japanese makes it seem like your soul exploded. it's about really thinking about the Japanese narratives around something, the concept of something being decentralized. It's about like having a very rigid hierarchical business culture here, the way that they do, and how to explain that to them. And that might be different. If you have a company like Consensus, let's say it has a project, and you're going to explain that project a little bit differently in different markets while still being accurate about the nature of the project. So, Jim.
Oh, no, I just had a question.
And you emphasize different things that you feel like are going to resonate the most with different markets, and that's why you have a team that has folks that are able to localize different markets, not just literally translate them, but genuinely localize them based on a real understanding of what people in that market care about.
Sorry, June, just really quickly. So because my role is, I cover Asia-Pacific, so this is something, and not specifically Asia, for Pacific is really Australia, and Australia is English, basically. So I don't have to worry that much with that. For Asia, I speak Chinese, but I don't speak Korean or Japanese.
You speak Mandarin or Cantonese?
Mandarin, I understand Cantonese.
Okay.
The tricky thing is, even that is a bit tricky, because Cantonese is totally different. It uses a Chinese script, but it's there are words that doesn't exist.
The grammar is different.
Yeah, so we've sort of, it's a learning process, but I think to sort of answer your question, it's both. It's a what we call, you know, this term is tossed around a lot by HSBC like 28 years ago. Global local.
Right.
But it's true, because when I put out certain announcement from stateside, and we sort of distribute that amongst the different offices in the region, we find out very interesting things. Like we had a piece of news about Kaleido, which is the business cloud itself. Japan, for some reason, our Japan colleague told me that is something that was really interesting. Then we had something else that came up, and then another country told us this is something we want. The translation, however, is something that we get local partners, we get external, and then the local office, they do that. Because you need that level. It comes back to a point, my half of the presentation is basically to emphasize that the local media represents the local readers. They are your audience. Ultimately, they are your consumer audience. So they need to understand the word. So if they're reading a blog or something, or they read something in, you know, on a website, on your website in English, they hit Google Translate, they're going to see the word soulless.
Yeah.
I don't think that's something you want. So I guess it depends on, from my point of view, it depends on how you're going to plan your, you know, plan of attack, your resourcing, and to make sure you have the proper representation, the proper community. Decades ago, from a marketing point of view, it was easy for companies to make a lot of mistakes, the one that you mentioned. And it's not just Asia. When they translate certain brand names into, you know, France or, you know,
oh,
Spanish, classic marketing.
I lived in Nigeria, and there was a air conditioning company, Haier, that moved into Nigeria, and they wanted to dominate the market for air conditioners, but they didn't understand the local pidgin. And when you say, I know go now, it means that I am going. And so this one of the marketing guys came in and he said, I'm going to put a billboard up and it's going to be an air conditioner and it's going to say, we know cool, which means we do not cool in the local language. But he wrote K-N-O-W, not N-O. So we know cool, and there's a lot of a high level of literacy in the area. So if somebody says, hey, what does that say? It says we know cool and has the air conditioner there, they're going to understand that air conditioner does not cool. So, that man did not last in that job for very long. And this is the reason why I came to hear you guys talk, because understanding and communicating Ethereum in the local language and the local ecosystems and how it translates is so important.
Yeah, it's really finding out, the language is a given, I feel. You really have to put in resources and commit to getting it translated accurately.
Right.
And the challenge is because our space is so new, blockchain is so young, Ethereum is so young, a lot of the words are new. DeFi, that came out of nowhere, didn't it? And then now it exists as a concept, as a philosophy, and how do you translate that into Korean, Japanese? And if you are going to the market, you know, if you go to the Myanmar, the language is going to be different. I have no idea what that translation would be, but you have to sort of do your homework, I feel, because this is so new. We are not in an established space where we're selling table and chair, the words are already established, the lexicon is there. The lexicon is still evolving for us. You know, next week we may have a totally new lexicon. Yeah. So, sorry, Julie, wanted to.
Oh no, I just had a question. So for you guys as communications practitioners, what do you see as the key platforms, titles, or maybe journalists, or social media channels? What are the key levers that you guys pull to get your message out?
I think it's completely dependent on the message and the goal. So, I mean, I want everyone to know what I'm doing and who I am, and this is the story, that's a very limited way to start. I think you have to work backward from, I want to take my product to Japan, and I want to get this amount of users in Japan, and here are the media outlets in Japan, and here are the things that they cover, here are the things that they don't cover, here's what bothers them, here's what they like. So I'm going to craft a story for my project, working backward based on where you want to place it. So it's never communication in a vacuum. It's always communication based on target audience. I would say that communications is a protocol or a practice rather than a set of stories or any sort of, don't you agree with this, right? Like any specific like piece of content. It's a way of behaving. It's an intellectual exercise of connecting the landing point with the existing entity or project while being representative of the thing. Does that make sense? So a lot of crypto projects want to land, I would say your standard issue thing is looking for, they're often looking for numbers, adoption numbers. if the thing you really care about is just high numbers of users, Indonesia, as Riley mentioned, is a great place to experiment and just get users, because the cost of user acquisition is really low. But the spending power of your average user is really, really low too. So that's a great place to optimize your product and your marketing campaign, and then take it into, there's some other places like that too, and then take it into a higher price point market. But then you might have to have two different price points. One for the folks in Indonesia that can't afford it once you move into, so you have to be thoughtful about it. And you have to be respectful about it, otherwise you're gonna have a negative brand backlash. So let's say we've gotten a bunch of users in Indonesia, now we're back advertising in the US. A lot of companies want to have some, if they're going for adoption in the crypto community, they want CoinDesk, they want Cointelegraph. If they're doing a product launch, they'll want it on TechCrunch. That they might be able to get something into like Fortune's The Ledger, Decrypt the Block. There's a whole cadre. And then, you know, usually startup founders in the space don't understand that they're gonna only get niche coverage, or like industry coverage first, because usually, like, the way that we talk to each other in this space is often a little bit grandiose. Changing, my thing is changing the world, why is this not the front page news of the New York Times, you know, and you lose track of what other people are thinking about and what other people's incentives are, and also how much technical knowledge people really have, especially when you're getting outside the industry media. And so that's why I put this quote from Matt Leising at Bloomberg on here, which is, don't dumb it down, but think of a colorful way to get your message across. So work on explaining in plain English what you're doing, and then maybe you can land some national stuff. So like FT is a great place to land a finance story, New York Times. Nat Popper is a really hard guy to get a hold of, but you can if it's really, really, really important. I hope you're watching this. Email me back. No, I'm just kidding. Matt Leising, it has to be a really high barrier to entry thing. Paul Vigna at the Wall Street Journal. Olaf Arif at Bloomberg also. Olga, who else are people really wanting to get in front of? Some Reuters people can get in front of. Yeah, I think those are like the ones that everyone's, those are the juicy ones that everybody wants. And then, I mean, so Quartz, back when you were, just to make it really personal, when you were reporting for Quartz, I had Quartz like very much in that list in my mind, but I don't think I've seen as much from them covering the space since you went to CoinDesk, but
Aaron? I don't remember his last name.
Aaron?
Aaron something.
Maybe Matt.
Matt is
over.
Oh, yeah.
Matt is
over. Yeah. And Forbes. I mean, Michael DelCastillo is there now. Laura Shinlin, there with that gave him a reputation. Yeah, those are the people that people want to land with. And then Twitter. Every startup cares so much about their Twitter because the space has such a crypto Twitter. Discord. People are having Discords now.
What's the list of those people in for Asian markets?
Asia is quite different. By languages, it's quite different. For media itself, it's tricky because what we consider the top tier, the Bloomberg, they are very hard to land. By default, the market in Asia are very focused on enterprise and numbers, facts and figures. Earlier on, I mentioned to hit Korea Times, to hit Choisan, which is Korea. They focus on stories related to Korea. If you are doing something in Samsung that helps, or with Samsung, let's say, that impacts a certain community group, you know, you're doing something that helps elderly in Seoul. That's a Korean story. It just makes no sense for me to push it to, you know, Japan, unless there was a relation. Now with the Bloomberg, the Reuters, they have national desks. With Bloomberg, CNBC, they tend to be a bit more regional. They like regional stories, highly competitive. If CNBC takes a story, Bloomberg may not, you know, like first exclusive, this is not new. Onto the social platform, that's a bit tricky because it's extremely diverse. WeChat, like I mentioned, that is the dominant platform for China, and it sort of covers into Hong Kong as well. You literally don't have to get out of WeChat app to live your life in China. Everything is, you know, it's one place. It does mean that you want your stories to go on WeChat. So I think you might have heard of Jingse Golden, which means I think golden color finance. They, if I'm right, they got booted off WeChat because they were seen as doing too many paid commentary, and that affected their numbers immediately. So WeChat, obviously, in parts of Asia, Line under Naver Group, that is big as well. Facebook, in parts of the developing market, social media, it's interesting, in parts of the, and it's something that, you know, we talk about, Joe Lubin talk about, in parts of Asia, social media equals internet. You wouldn't think of it that way. I mean, you would still go to Google in the morning, or you know, you go to FT, you go to Yahoo or something, I'm sure about Yahoo, but you do that. In parts of developing market, social media is the internet, is how they get information. That's why there's so much concern with Facebook and fake news, Facebook accepting ads that may have a hidden agenda, you know, things like this. That's the challenge that Facebook is facing, and any other social media platform, but Facebook is de facto, so you know, I forgot the word for it, but very unpleasant news this is the case with developing markets. So Line is biggest in Thailand as well. So for instance, if we were to get a piece of news in Bangkok Post, which is the sort of like national English language in Thailand, that's a huge hit. That's a huge hit if you want your channel to read it, because it's in English. But if you want a local consumer to read it, he or she isn't going to read the Bangkok Post. He or she is going to see what's online, what's on Facebook. So that's a sort of, it sounds expensive now if you have to split everything, but you have to, like what Amanda mentioned, who's your target audience, what is the goal, what is, and then you move backward, what becomes the channel.
So just to add some more, that this might even be slightly disturbing, but so the way that we organize the PR team at Consensus is that we have Asia and US, Europe, represented in-house, and then we use external firms all over the world to get more reach. So we're coordinating with internal full-time folks, with external agencies. So we were thinking about having a PR agency in South Africa. And we were interviewing these PR agencies, and they kept on sending me decks for content creation. And I didn't understand why in all of their SOWs, if content creation, we have a content team, just PR, like just talk to the journalists and localize the message for the journalists there. And it was so confusing that they explained to me, there's no difference. The PR writes every story, and then they publish it. And there's no, like they were so confused.
I did not know this.
That there's this, they're like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, so there's a different thing going on with just like what media is and how it works in different markets. And so assuming that everything about narrative construction works in the same way around the world, and I actually do think that part's fairly similar between Asia and US and Europe, but it's not necessarily true everywhere.
Well, I think that's a really interesting point. Like where you have a dominance of cell phones, you're going to have a dominance of media through things like WeChat, Line, and Facebook. And that then allows you, or gives you an opportunity to do your own PR as news, right? And also to use influencers, right, in those communities who have big audiences. Right?
Like when you asked a question earlier on about the penetration rate for mobiles or something. That's exactly the case. If in the developing region whereby their average income is lower than if you compare it to Singapore or the US or Hong Kong, they are all going to have a headphone. They are not going to have a laptop, and the experience is different. They are not going to look at the news on a laptop, but they are going to share the news and communicate with each other. If I'm a farmer, I'm going to be out on the farm. I'm going to rely on this to get weather forecast. So that's very that sort of understanding the purpose for them to communicate. We say content, but they want it for a specific purpose. Do they want to know the weather forecast? Do they need to know the price of grain? Is there an earthquake that will affect their shipment? So this is how their world is constructed. And I think there is a very clear opportunity for Ethereum and blockchain, because if you are able to get those things, the pickup is very fast.
And you mentioned influencer, but in different markets have very different perspectives on influencer marketing, especially right now. Like right now, I would never recommend that a company in the English speaking market explicitly have like an influencer promotion program, because I think it would induce a lot of skepticism. But there are markets where I would think that was okay, and I would have an English speaking company genuinely go out to people that are important in the market that are very followed and say, do you actually like this thing and will you help me? As opposed to like, here's tokens.
Well, I think particularly in like the brand and e-commerce marketing in China, it's all influencer marketing.
Totally. And so it's really, really different perceptions of that, and it's normal over here and it's viewed with like a little grain of skepticism over here.
Sorry.
I just have a question.
So
I have a question on, you know, feedback system for localization, because, so, I mean, I think, and I think everyone else will agree that if you want to build a narrative, consistency is one of the key factors. And, but if you have a, when you are trying to do localization of those narratives, it is very difficult to kind of, well, to provide QC, because you don't know the language. And if you have like a kind of a local nationale in your team, it can be provided. But if that's not the case, I was wondering how you kind of make sure that narrative is localized well, and how it is, you know, how you get your getting good feedback. Because I mean, if you have partners, maybe you delegate that.
Yep.
But again, you cannot ensure that those partners are doing a good job. So that if you have those suspicion, if you have those doubts, how do you get the feedback, and how do you kind of make sure that the narrative is going out the system?
Yeah, so a bigger problem outside of that is that Ethereum, no one runs the marketing or PR for Ethereum or can control what the Ethereum narrative is, because the community is decentralized. So even if we did have one narrative, like that to localize, we don't even have that. So we have a problem like a layer out from that in terms of like consistency and control. And then on top of that, you know, one layer in, at the your question layer, sometimes you mess up. You know, like there is a market where we had a partner that we realized pretty quickly, you know, wasn't doing a good job and maybe didn't have a good reputation. The moment we found that out, which we found out from, you know, just growing our presence in that market, we switched it. And we, you know, very politely, we switched that up. So, I mean, not a huge deal, but just like this intermediary wasn't doing a great job translating everything, and we wanted to have a better translator. So you find out from other locals, but that's the way to find out.
So you find out from other locals.
I wish it's feedback. And so triangulation is also super important. Triangulating with another disinterested group. So let's say you go into a market, you're translating your content, and it's a market where you don't have anyone on your team, so you've hired some kind of intermediary. You ask someone that they don't know to review the thing. I wish I could tell you that there was like an algorithm for it, but it's like a manual, conceptual kind of process.
Yeah, I just asked because localization can be disastrous in many regions. Yeah.
Oh, it can be. I mean, you need to do that. You need to be rigorous about that, because then you could be like shot in a certain region without even doing anything wrong. Somebody was like, not literally, like have your brand reputation shot, not be like physically shot. Yes.
Just wanted to add on to specifically for Ethereum, maybe not so much for other projects. Since it's decentralized and no one actually owns it, someone like, say, the foundation or consensus could there's narratives that you want to push out or definitions that you want to have like explained to the layman. It could be done in a sort of open source way, let's say on GitHub or whatever. And there are local people who are, you know, interested. So if there is a way where those people can have some sort of reputation check that, you know, it's not some nobody trying to show their own projects, then you can reach out to them and they can sort of translate it or interpret it in their own local context.
So that completely exists, and the ethereum.org website is that. So there are translators from all different languages translating all the content on ethereum.org, which is the site with the domain authority for Ethereum. And so if you look at the ethereum.org Twitter, they tweet each time they roll out a new language. And this wonderful woman, Taeyong Kim, who's Korean, who's here, has been running that program. And there are more and more languages. There are now hundreds and hundreds of contributors. And all of it's done through GitHub. So exactly, and yes, 100%. And it's been really strong, right? Like crowdsourcing translations and then having a professional look it over before it goes out. So it's ranking for SEO. And then the other thing that I would definitely recommend getting involved with, because I started it 3 days ago with a big group of people, was is Marketing DAO. So the idea is to, we launched it at the Moloch DAO meetup, and the idea is to get a bunch of stakeholders in the space together to create the funding and governance mechanism for properly marketing and messaging Ethereum. Because, you know, there should be some independent entity that does that, that has the proper expertise to do it. So there's a Telegram channel, there's going to be a Twitter, looking for members and looking for members that can help work on it, and probably it'll end up being paid opportunities for people because there'll be funding going to it. Knock on this.
That's awesome. That's funny. I'm trying to start a new staff. We'll call it DAO Desk.
Are you?
Are you? Okay.
I'm trying to tweet it into existence.
I'll go tweet it. If it's tweeted, it's true.
Yeah. But I had a question. So, as you know, you guys are kind of meme hustlers, right? Narrative peddlers. What are the hot narratives that you're selling today? What's hot in Asia?
What's hot in Asia?
Yeah.
I would say it's not actually defined yet, but it's still gonna. The lady who just left, she did mention that a lot of the thought process still originates from what we call US Cobra, which is it is the case. Asia is still very focused on enterprise. Like, it's extremely focused on enterprise. So the business side of things, you know, when I don't represent the business role, but that business side of things is about how do we get something created. So the conversation has shifted from what is blockchain, how does this work to POC? It's way past POC. Now businesses don't need you to explain, they don't need us to explain what is blockchain. What is it? What is this magical thing? How? The question is HOW, how? How will you make this work? And they tend to already have a certain idea that they want, that the thought process has already been digested internally. If I'm a business in a certain sector, I want something a certain way, can you create this for me? Will you roll this out for me? That is the conversation at the business level now. It's beyond POC. It's already beyond POC.
Yeah, I think maybe we went over this before you came in, but I think the stories that people really want to tell right now are stories with real numbers in them. So either it's an enterprise spending real money or making real money, or it's something with major funding, or it's something with major customers. So if there's a number people like that right now, then DeFi, people are trying to figure out what it is, trying to follow it. Ethereum 2.0 and roadmap, scaling. I think those are probably the things people are looking for right now. I think some people are interested in this next round of the next IEO thing, if there's another thing that looks kind of like ICOs but is located somewhere different.
Given the enterprise thirst, do you work with people like EY and Nightfall to push that into the enterprise space in Asia, or is that too partner specific at your level?
I don't have the information specifically. It's something that I should check, because I'm not a developer background myself, so there may be conversations about this that I'm not familiar with, so I can't quite answer that. But this is specific to EY's Nightfall, right?
Yeah. It just seems like they're doing really great things on the enterprise to make use and publish that, or have those enterprise users interact with the public chain.
Yeah.
I think there's very close connectivity
I'm
between
sure.
the
yeah.
team there,
yeah, okay.
Consensus and the Ethereum space. And they're speaking. I saw them yesterday.
They were yesterday. Yeah,
they're part of our whole jam for sure.
I like the name.
Yeah, I know.
I know.
Good,
it's like,
brand.
Oh, I wish I had that. Okay, are we done for time?
Sorry, we're getting some kind of time message from the
yeah.
back. What is that time message that you're giving us? It looks like a string of matrix numbers.
What is this?
Okay, great. I guess we're just not going to do that exercise. Nobody seems to really want to.
Unless someone wants to pitch the idea to CoinDesk. Who's sitting right there?
The embodiment of CoinDesk. No, you're now the embodiment of DAO.
The DAO Desk. Maybe you guys can introduce a bit more about marketing DAO and DAO Desk.
Well, June, do you want to pitch DAO Desk?
Sure. So the argument goes like this, right? If news is a commons and a public good, then who should fund that public good?
And the answer is the people who are affected by the news. So if we want to create a news source to cover cryptocurrency, then we could imagine, you know, the top 10 public chains, the top 10 exchanges, the biggest wallets, the biggest VCs, they should all be members of this DAO. They should put funds into the DAO so that the DAO can allocate the resource to create news gathering teams to cover this conference. And if you want to make it a revenue generating DAO, then that DAO could own some assets, like, let's call it DAODesk.com. And DAODesk.com is the place that the news that's approved by the DAO gets published, and it's the place that advertising and other revenue generating things can be attached to it and can be fed back in the DAO.
Sounds like we should definitely work together with Marketing DAO and DAODesk.
Marketing DAO could market DAODesk.
I mean, DAODesk could be like the PR, the like right. Publication outlet of Marketing DAO.
Yes. DAODesk like, is registered.
By
you. No, I'm not that smart.
Yeah, Sam just did it right now. What is going on? Sam just spotted on your
spotting
domain.
Spotting, man. Just selling it to you.
Classic spell desk with a Q.
You have a Q. Okay, let's try.
DAO.desk.
Sam is squatting on every possible iteration.
It's available. And any more questions from even other regions or something? Something you guys want to do in Asia? Roblox?
Yes.
I'm just more of an enthusiast here, so I spend a lot of my time reading a lot of the publications from this here. From where I sit, I still feel like people use the word Bitcoin to represent blockchain, or there's a great article that comes out on news of Ethereum, and it's like they've gone through the article and removed the word Ethereum and put the word blockchain into it.
Do you know why from this presentation?
Well, you're trying to appeal to a larger mass of people?
So yeah, it's SEO, right? It's a calculated decision.
It's infuriating from my point of view.
So I was at Huffington Post in like 2013, and one thing that we would do is we would just put like Kim Kardashian into the base name of the URL for nearly everything. So you would go to like any like news article, and there would be all this stuff in the base name of the URL that just was stuff, right? Like keywords. And so it's not like something malicious that media has against Ethereum. They're just going to go with what's the most recognized, because it's like they're going to cover like a zebra walking down Fifth Avenue, but they're not going to cover a zebra in the zoo. And they're not going to cover, you know, something that's small, something that's not important, something that doesn't stand out. And Bitcoin makes it stand out more because it's better known. We went over those numbers with the 75% versus the 17%. And so the way to fix that is to get Ethereum more known. And the more known Ethereum is, the more likely media is to put it in a headline. There's a really funny Twitter account though called Built on ETH, which tweets out every article that is about something that's built on Ethereum that doesn't mention that it's built
on Ethereum.
And it's really funny. They do a good job. They do a really good job. And the other thing is, one trend I've noticed with crypto and blockchain startups, and I can't decide whether this is good or bad, they don't mention that they're on blockchain at all. And they're mostly on Ethereum. Like the last time I checked, something like 96% of projects built on Ethereum, built on blockchain, or built on Ethereum. When people say blockchain, they usually mean Ethereum. But, you know, blockchain is a much bigger keyword than Ethereum still, and Bitcoin is a bigger keyword than blockchain. And lots of companies don't even want it to be associated with cryptocurrency because of the recalibration. So that's where we are right now, and there need to be applications of Ethereum that build up the name recognition. There needs to be a meme for so Bitcoin. So here's a challenge: Bitcoin is digital gold, store of value. There are all these memes about Bitcoin, and Ethereum doesn't really have a meme right now, and so. There's a zillion-dollar competition going on, or an infinitely scalably remunerative competition for who can figure out a meme for Ethereum. Because programmable money doesn't really cover it. Smart contract platform, like nobody's looking for that, not yet.
What we talked about last night, the biggest blockchain actually gets the word blockchain.
Yeah, last night we were talking about calling it the biggest blockchain. And then there'd be a sister company called the Bestest Blockchain.
The Bestest.
So I like the biggest. as blockchain.
Yeah, I think that's not old yet, I think.
So there's a great book called The 22 Immutable Laws of Marketing, and basically you can only think about one thing occupying one hyperbole. So you have a space, like a bowling alley in your mind for each hyperbole, and you only get one, you get to lodge one thing there. So like the safest car is Volvo, you know, and no one else can be the safest car. You have to be the something else's car, you have to be the flashiest car, you have to be the loudest car, you have to be the, I don't really like cars, so it's all negative. You have to be the something. And Ethereum's still working on that. And gosh, should I try in my capacity of consensus to make that, and it's not made yet. So let's work on it.
The cutest blockchain.
That's Doge. You see, exactly. That's
immediate. When I say cutest Doge, which is true, there's so many pictures.
Three minutes left.
Who are the personalities in Ethereum who you guys have found to be the most marketable? Is it like, for example,
so Vitalik?
Is it Vitalik? Is it
so Vitalik? It's interesting. People think that Joe is one, and this is just talking about them as like objects. This doesn't include like the warmth of their personality or like whether they're like good people or what they eat for breakfast, but just looking at them as memes. Vitalik is a zebra walking down Fifth Avenue because of his age. It's very unusual to have someone that young creating something this impactful. And so, and also being so articulate in many of the ways that he's so articulate. So that's why that was listed as one of the core stories from the very beginning, because of that persona. Whereas you get someone with someone like Joe's background more often in that kind of position. That doesn't lessen his ability as a storyteller in the space, but it's certainly like a less unusual profile. And that's better for certain situations and worse for other situations. So what I like is that there's actually such a variety of characters in the space that sub into the situations that make the most sense. I think the two of them are the ones that I think of the most along with Ethereum. Does that resonate with you, or is that just me living in my world of consensus pure?
Maybe, I don't know, but to hear from the jurors, so I guess for Asia specifically too, for like Singapore, Vitalik, definitely Joe, yes. For Joe is a bit specific, they tend to look at him from the, because Singapore is such a financial hub, they look at it from the financial hub, and it ties back a bit. For Vitalik, I mentioned earlier in the deck, he's big in the Chinese speaking via Taiwan, China by association, so we have a China sort of covering. Hong Kong, I haven't got a grasp where his sort of place is, I guess, but Taiwan, Hong Kong, that sort of thing, that's covered.
Is there anyone that you think of as being like
secret heroes?
And then there are a bunch of kind of people that technical people know, like Carl Flores, Danny Bryan, and then I would say that people know Aya. I think people on the I think we've got some folks here that when you go to the enterprise side of this are like the main folks, like your, it's a pantheon of different deities for different occasions.
Well, I also think that we as developers get stuck in marketing to this tiny little ecosystem, right? And if we're going to actually get this story to be a bigger story, we have to find the memes that actually work.
The biggest story.
Yes.
Yeah, it's something that we hear a lot. So developers are not necessarily businessmen. Businessmen are not necessarily developers. The language is by default. By default. Anyway,
we're out of time.
Thank you. That was awesome.
Thank you.